If I could have your attention. We have a short announcement by Dr. George Snell.
I've been asked by the Missionary Department of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints to ask if there are physicians who are Spanish-speaking or Portuguese-speaking and retired or near retirement. They are in need of area medical advisors to serve in Latin America in particular. Please contact me, or you can contact Elder Clayton, Weatherford Clayton's office directly at the Missionary Department. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Snell. Just a short reminder this evening, at Layton Hills Mall, everyone's invited with their families, immediate families, to go to the Davis Medical Center and Tanner Clinic family event, which is the aquarium is exclusively open for members of the society and their families, and also Dartside Dart Tag is available for all members and their families. So please consider that this evening if you're looking for a very fun family activity. It's now my pleasure to introduce our speaker for the lunch hour. Dr. Jeffrey T. Hershey is a national speaker and a local emergency room physician at McKady Hospital. From 1999 to 2002, he was the Olympic Race Patrol Director for the Salt Lake City Olympics. He was a professional ski patroller at Snow Basin for 7 years. During that time, he was on the explosives team, became the avalanche control leader and the hill and search and rescue captain. In 2013, he returned and became Snow Basin's on-hill physician. While he was away, he earned his DO at Touro University, Nevada College of Osteopathic Medicine in Las Vegas. He did make the dean's list all 4 years, if anybody's curious. In 2013, he received a fellow of the Academy of Wilderness Medicine at the Wilderness Medical Society in Salt Lake City. He completed residency in 2013 at Michigan State University Emergency Medicine in Lansing, Michigan. He's given the lecture that he's going to present to us many, many times. Often he's been nominated and voted the best lecturer at the conference. When I asked him how he wanted to be introduced, he said, just say I'm a ski bum with a great job. So the time is now for Jeff.
Is this working? Everybody hear me on this one? Not a problem? Thanks for having me. I'm very, very happy to be back at Weber State. This is where I graduated. I went to college for like 9 years because I was a ski bum, and that's the honest truth. Many great people here that helped me out, Dr. Vandegraaff being one of them in the pre-med up there at our old science building. But Weber State treated me really, really great, and I've been able to achieve my dreams as a launching pad from Weber State. So it's been really, really fun, especially to come back here and to be able to deliver a lecture as an alumnus. Holy cow. So very appreciative of the introduction, and I really appreciate Dr. Reifelman. One of the experiences that helped me become a physician is I was a ski patroller up at Snow Basin, and I always kind of knew that I wanted to be, you know, pre-dent, pre-med, pre-something, but I didn't really know what it was. And it was my first year as a ski patroller up at Snow Basin. Just as the expansion year happened, John Paul Lift just went in. And we were just wrapping up the day. I had just finished my EMT. I was very excited about all my new training. And at the end of the day, I hear, before I see, I hear some scraping and a small yell. And it was a gentleman that went off the very top of Mount Allen. And Mount Allen, if you're standing at the very top of it, looks like a phenomenal ski run. Like, it's pristine. Unfortunately, it ends up in a 426-foot cliff. And this gentleman was way out of town and probably just did not know where he was going, skied off this thing, snowboarded off of it, and then tomahawked and landed at the bottom of this thing in a pile of blood and bones. And I ran up as fast as I could with backboard, sea collar, oxygen, all the trauma stuff, ran up all the way to the base of this cliff, where this gentleman was still alive, and put him on a backboard, straightened out his femur, straightened out his arm, put an oxygen bottle on him, a C-collar on him, and I'll never forget this frustration that I had inside me. I looked and I went, gosh, that's all I know how to do? You know, like that kind of ticked me off. And Dr. Brian Smith, who was the ski patrol doctor up at Snow Basin, shows up about 15 minutes later, riding backwards on a snowmobile, gets off the snowmobile, runs up our boot pack, needle decompresses this guy, intubates him, right on the scene, and says, Hershey, get me to that helicopter. I've never been more impressed in my entire life. I was like, this is incredible. He does CPR on this guy all the way down to the helicopter, gets into the life flight helicopter, and flies up and over this mountain range just where he's an ER doctor over at McCady Hospital. Wow. I remember standing underneath the helicopter as it's taking off, and I remember thinking, no one can hear me. I remember looking at the bottom of that helicopter, and I said out loud, well, I'm not going to be a dentist. Brian and I are now partners in the ER, and he's been a tremendous influence in my life, and I owe a tremendous amount to him. So always thank him. What one is forward?
Green Circle Center.
Green Circle Center. So I do appreciate you guys being here. I started this lecture back in residency, and it's grown from here. This is a very personal lecture, and I think you'll understand this here in a while. But there's a set of collective traits that bring us all together here. Has anybody been on an accident scene, just anywhere, out in the community, and you see two cars go, and it's really interesting to see how people segregate themselves. There are people that literally cannot get out of their car, and they call 911 while somebody's dying over there. And that's okay. I think you and I probably run into that scene. We get into the car. We see their airway. We stop the bleeding. We push pressure on something that needs pressure. But there's, you know, certain people just can't approach that. And here, you and I share a whole body of selective and collective traits that bring us together as physicians, nurses, paramedics, EMTs, PAs, nurse practitioners, because that's who we are. We're broken that way. Who here, and I maybe need to exclude, I'll have to exclude any ER doctor or trauma surgeon here. You can't answer. But in any community, I don't care where you are, I don't care if it has mountains, oceans, or whatever, what is clearly the most dangerous thing you could possibly end up doing in any community? I'm an ER doc, so just... Okay, bathtub stuff. Okay, we got driving. I've heard trampolines. Okay, those are all good answers. It turns out that all of those are wrong. Okay, you know, it turns out that minding your own business is clearly the most dangerous thing you could possibly do. Okay, like how many times have you and I heard this, right? I was just minding my own business when these two guys. I can't even tell you how many times. This is real, real stuff. Okay. People show up, this is the honest truth, and this is what they tell me. It's 3:30 in the morning, and they were just walking around minding their own business when these two guys jumped out and knifed them or whatever, right? And these two guys have never been caught, by the way. These same two people, okay? They've assaulted millions, but nobody can catch them, okay? Like, I want to dictate this chart one day, okay? Like, maybe by the end of my career, I'm going to dictate this exact chart. Okay, this is a 26-year-old male presenting to the ER with via EMS, GCS of 3. He's just obviously minding his own business walking down the street. This is so clear, okay, based on the clinical presentation. Patient has two bullet holes in his torso, a knife protruding from his left kidney, a reverse impression of Louisville Slugger over the course of his forehead, right? Then the obvious next stage, of course, is that this guy's only had two beers, right? You know, I've seen, like in the emergency department, I've seen UA samples come back with a cocktail olive in it. One night I saw like a mosquito land on this guy, suck blood from him, and the mosquito flew straight into the wall. Okay, like that's those are the kind of alcohol levels we see in the ER. Okay, where do these guys get this? Where the rest of us are stuck with 3-2 beer. You know, it's basically water. Even if you know somebody on base, you don't know how these guys get so drunk on 2 beers. Okay? So in general, I just don't ever mind my own business, ever, ever. I have subscription to People Magazine, TMZ, whatever. Anything to get into somebody else's business, it's safer that way. Okay? I will have you put your fork down and pick your phone or your pen up. And I need you to write this down. This is homework for this lecture. I need everybody to write this down, and I need you to go to like Amazon or HBO or whatever and find a way to get this movie, and I want you to watch it. Okay? If you're in charge of students, you need to watch this, and you need to show this to them. If you're a doctor, I don't know who that might be here, you need to watch this. Who has seen this? Anybody in here seen this? Very few. Okay? Is it worth your time? Yes? Okay? It's really, really excellent. In short, this is a play that has been turned into a movie, and Emma Thompson, who is phenomenal in this movie, takes you through her hospital course as she is diagnosed with stage 4 ovarian cancer. She's given experimental doses of chemotherapy and a new medication, and she takes you through this experience through her own eyes. Some of her doctors are her former students, as she's an English professor. Some of it embarrassing. Some of it illustrates how unhuman medicine can be within our institutions. This is what it looks like, the cover, so when you are searching for this, you'll know what it looks like. One of the most poignant scenes that I remember in this is she announces grand rounds. She is sitting in her bed, and the camera's from her perspective. She's sitting there, and she announces grand rounds. And what comes in but the attending physician in his coat, and then the 17 sheeple behind him with their books and notes, writing everything down judiciously and studiously. And then the next scene is 10 pairs of hands as the bed covers come off, and they all reach in to push on her belly. They go over the bioavailability under the curve. They go under pKa value. They go over what dose, what round, blah, 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 and they never address her. They never say, how are you? How are you feeling today? What are the side effects doing to you? Are you hungry? Anything. What's your favorite color? Anything. And then the residents get in a little pissing match as to who's smartest, and then they leave. This movie is full of lots of these moments. And so I need you to all watch this as we kind of consider the joys of medicine. I think you'd all agree that it's about people and our connections with them, not pKa values. Okay? Now, who's seen this? See if maybe I'm out of range. There it is. Simon Sinek. Who has seen this online? Anybody? Okay. 18 minutes. It's phenomenal. It's a really, really, really good 18 minutes. And I want you to watch this with several different hats. You can watch this with your business hat, your medical hat, your parenting hat. I don't care what, but you need to watch this about 2 or 3 times. Tonight I expect roughly 300 new hits on YouTube. I have no financials or anything to any of this, Simon Sinek or anything. What he does is he talks about and illustrates how the vast majority of people, companies, businesses, individuals, communicate from the outside of this circle in. Everybody starts with what. They work into where, like how they do things, and very few people are able to communicate why they do things. He says the real true orators or the true communicators, the true leaders in business, industry, or individuals communicate completely opposite as normal everyday companies, businesses, or individuals. They communicate from the inside of this circle outwards. They always start with why. Okay? And he gives several examples of this. As we go through, I'll talk about this, okay? But I want everybody to YouTube this, watch this. It's 18 minutes. And I think you go, oh my gosh, wow, how did I miss this? Or how did I not figure this out earlier? Okay? Because everybody really knows what you do. You and I walk into a room, the person's in a doctor's office or an ER or a clinic of some kind, and you walk in with a white coat, scrubs, and a stethoscope. I mean, is there any mystery whatsoever as to what you do? There is zero mystery. And so there's really almost no point in explaining that to anyone as to what you do. Nobody, it turns out, cares. Nobody cares about that, okay? You know, like, a few people know how you and I do this. But let me give you an example of what this means. Like on Channel 5 News tonight at 10 o'clock, I guarantee you that it's never going to happen as some big case comes through the news that Keith McCord with his toupee or whatever says, you know, I think it's real, comes in and says, you know, in a moment of sheer genius, Dr. Hershey switches from a Miller 4 to a Mac 5 and saves this guy's life more at 10. Are you ever going to hear that? I mean, I promise you, you will not hear that. At a crucial moment, Dr. Hylison switches from Augmentin to Levaquin based on the pKa value, whatever that is. More news at 10, full story pending. Because it turns out, like, we can't even explain to people very often how you and I do this. How do you say that? How do you communicate that on a large scale? To talk about bioavailability under the curve for a new medication? Or why you switched to the Miller 3? Or why you decided to, you know, put the needle decompression on the lateral aspect rather than supraclavicular? Nobody cares. And you'll never hear this discussed. Like, who loves the bureaucracy of their job? Raise your hand. I know there's a few policy wonks out there, but who loves the bureaucracy of your job? Raise your hand. Who loves going through a really tough case? It's full of action, full of immediate things. You save the day. The person lives, whatever it might be. And then you just can't wait to get back and dictate. Oh, yes. How many review assistants can I get on this one? Yes, so fun, right? So great. Or to go document how much fentanyl you used. I mean, does anybody love that? Or checking the Medicare, Medicaid billing and sliding scale to see if this counts? Are you going to get paid for this? Because I guarantee you, like that right there up on screen, that's what woke me up today. That's why I woke up today. And I would wager that that's what brings you and me together with these shared character flaws, if you will. You and I are compelled to go into that accident while somebody else will call from the sidewalk and tell them somebody's hurt, somebody's injured, somebody needs somebody that's willing to go in and help. Well, this is why I got out of bed. I've thought long and hard about this. And I've tried to figure this out from a very young age as to why I'm compelled to do this. I was you've already heard I was a ski patroller, search and rescue. I've done search and rescue work on Denali. If you boil it all down, it's all the same exact problem that I have. And it turns out that they're the exact same pathway to the same problem, is that I need to be there for you when you need me. That's my why. Every last one of those pathways is the exact same avenue to fulfilling the problem that I have. I need to be there for you when you need me. One morning in the ER over here at McKady Hospital where I practice, I remember coming in. It was a 6 a.m. shift. It was bitterly cold outside. I remember it was around 5, maybe 0 degrees, cold, clear night. And I was just settling in and starting up my computer when a phone call from EMS came across to the charge nurse, and they said, we've got somebody coming in, and they apparently a drunk guy that was found on 25th Street as somebody was opening their business found this guy out on a park bench and just called 911. 911 arrived, and this guy is stone cold drunk and has been out all night long. Now, this is not important for me and you to go over the treatment of hypothermia in a drunk patient. His core temperature was 81. He was done shivering. His airway needed to be protected, and we needed to go super aggressive. But that's not why I'm telling you this story, because what happened is that as EMS came in, there were six of them. They usually run in two rigs. Every last one of them came in t-shirts. It's 5 degrees outside. Every last one of those EMS folks came in t-shirts, no gloves, no hats, no jackets. Where was it? It was on our patient. I stood in the corner and cried because they didn't even realize they did it. Their heart beats the same, and they have to act. That's love of fellow man. This drunk, who may be drunk today, has no capacity to say thank you, no capacity to pay you back financially or otherwise. And yet, here's my ambulance crew on a day that's 5 degrees, and they're all in t-shirts, and their gear is on our patient. They've done everything they can for him. Everything they can. Those types of things bring us together. That's humanity. Those types of cases move me tremendously. I mean, this is true. Like, I've just always been the same guy. When I was 6 years old, my mom literally, no joke, built a dummy because she got sick of being the victim. We still have the thing. It's real. She got sick of being the victim. She's like, I gotta make dinner. I can't sit here and have CPR done on me for the next 12 hours. Because I've had the same need my whole life, right? It's selfish. It's interesting, right? My needs are selfish. It just happens to benefit other people. It's a sick way to think about this, but that's me. Ask yourself why you do this, because we know what you do. Some of us know how you do it. I'm an ER doc. I know the first 15 minutes of everything all of you guys do. After that, I need to call you. Who has seen the movie Kung Fu Panda? Anybody familiar with that movie? Or Lego movie? All these movies are the exact same, okay? So everybody watches these movies and they're very, very funny, and they leave these movies thinking, oh, that was a great line, this is a great funny thing. Kung Fu Panda is a pretty popular movie, and it's a series. Jack Black is one of the actors in it, and he's the big fat Kung Fu Panda. This is about, I'll explain the movie a little bit more since some of you have not seen it. It's a movie about a big fat panda. And he lives in a village where he's an adopted kid. His dad's a goose who does noodles. He's a noodle guy. He runs a noodle company. But Po is his name, and he wants to be a kung fu master. Like, it's one of his dreams, right? But he has no way to do it. He's huge. He doesn't look like a kung fu anything. And he has no skills or background in order to be able to achieve this. One day, up on this huge hill where the king and emperor and all these other things live, there's these five people that they call the Furious Five that are training to be what's going to ultimately be called the Dragon the Kung Fu Master, the Dragon Master. Dragon Warrior, I think, is that? Dragon Warrior? And he wants to see this happen and see who this guy chooses so bad that he does everything he possibly can to get into that courtyard to see who's going to be chosen as the dragon warrior. One of the things that he does, he tries to climb the wall, he tries to peer through the holes, he tries to everything he can to get into that thing. And one of the things he ends up doing, he launches himself with a bunch of fireworks on the bottom of a chair, launches himself into the air, it explodes, and then he falls directly down into the courtyard where the Kung Fu master is going to point, and he points directly at this big fat panda that just fell directly in front of him. Nothing had changed about his past. Nothing had changed about his physique. Nothing had changed about his skill set. Nothing. But he was called, "You're going to be the dragon warrior." What these shows all have in common is that they say there is this horrible, dark prophecy coming to destroy us. And it just so happens that you're the only one that can save us. You're special. You're the only one that can save us. And so, in the course of these movies, they do. They go about and they save the world. And so he does. He becomes this dragon warrior. One of the things that he sees in order to become the dragon warrior after he's completed his kung fu training, which he does really good at, he's given this scroll. And as soon as he's opened this scroll, he's supposed to be given limitless power. And this limitless power is there to, he can defeat any enemy that comes his way, anything that happens, he can defeat it once he opens this scroll and becomes the dragon warrior. Well, they knock this scroll off. He's completed all his training. He's ready to finally become the dragon warrior. He opens the scroll, and it's blank. This whole thing is blank, and he kind of goes, well, maybe this was all just a big hoax. This was all just a bunch of gobbledygook anyway. And he walks down the stairs back to where his dad is a noodle guy, defeated. And in that same instant, he's not the dragon warrior anymore. One instance, somebody pointed at him and said, "You're special, you're the dragon warrior." He became the dragon warrior. The other instance, he sees something that's not what he expects, and he disbelieves, and he walks down the stairs defeated. And he's no longer the dragon warrior. He gets down to his dad, and his dad has this famous soup that he has, and it's called his secret ingredient noodle soup. And he comes down defeated. He was supposed to save the village and the universe from these bad things that are supposed to happen, but he can no longer do it because he's not the dragon warrior. And his dad finally introduces him and says, "Son, let me tell you something about my secret ingredient noodle soup." He says, "There is no secret ingredient." He goes, "What, Dad? There's no secret ingredient to your secret ingredient noodle soup?" He's like, "How can that be?" He says, "It turns out, son, that in order to be special, you just have to believe that it's special." Then he pulls that scroll out, realizes it's not blank, it's a reflection. And he looks back at himself and he realizes that he just has to believe that he's special. And he walks back up those stairs and he kicks Tai Lung's butt and he saves the universe and everything's great. Right? That's what all these shows are about. Every last one of them. Star Wars, Luke Skywalker, some forlorn, lonely planet, nothing special about him. Somebody comes down and says, "You're the only one that can save us from this dark prophecy that's going to come and destroy the universe. You're the only one that can do it." And so he does. Harry Potter, some kid that lives at the base of some stairwell in his adopted family, nothing special about him. Somebody finally shows up on his 11th birthday and says, "Hey, look, kid, there's some dark prophecy coming. It's going to destroy our world. You're the only one that can save us." And so he does. Over and over and over, these films are exactly the same, over and over. They tell us how to be special. You just have to believe so. Now, as I look out in this audience, this dark prophecy, you and I have all got this version of it, right? For me, it's trauma, an acute illness. For somebody else, it's broken bones, bone cancer, pediatric heart illness, inborn errors of metabolism, geriatrics, cancer, renal failure. All of these are these dark prophecies that are going to come and destroy our world. And it turns out that you and me are the only ones that can save it. After being involved in saving a life, I was trapped and I just couldn't I couldn't go back and sell the widget or the doodad. Couldn't do it. There's just no soul-satisfying repercussions to that. I once sold 22 kayak paddles to 22 ski patrollers that don't kayak. Like, my wife's ticked off at me that I'm not a salesman because we'd probably live higher on the hill. But I just can't do it. One morning, I was in the ER, minding my own business, which is always dangerous, when we get a call over the head, over the intercom. Dr. Alley, were you here that day? I think Rob was here that day. This'll show you what wisdom will do. I ran fastest. Rob walked slow. Okay, that's wisdom. That's experience. I ran out because we got a call. We need a doctor out in the turnabout where people come in through the drive-thru in the ER. Now, we're in Utah, so there's only two options. One, it's a gangbang drop-off. They drop them off dead with a knife in them. We got to go save them. Or two, it's childbirth. Like, I don't even know what they do in Utah County. They probably just have a doctor sitting out there just like, bring it. Let's go. Somebody give me a new pair of scrubs. Yeah, it's only been 10 minutes, I know. So I ran out there, you know, as fast as I could. And I got there first, and sure enough, I kind of like take a breath, like, oh, good, because I see 2 feet up on the dashboard of this poor car that's being christened with amniotic fluid. And I get out there, and I ask, you know, what's the first question I want to ask the woman that's delivering? What's the only thing I really want to know? Is it your first? That's a good question. I always ask, how far along are you? Okay, because that's really what I want to know. And to my horror, she says 27 weeks. Oh. Oh, gosh. Changed my diaper already. So it's 27 weeks. It's early April, and it's early in the morning, so it's cold outside. I said, okay, well, ma'am, I got to get down to the business end, and we got to look at this and see what we're dealing with. So I get down to business end. What's the first thing I see but baby's breech? Yeah, baby's breech. So scroll back through some of the files in my head and see how we're going to do this, what maneuver we're going to use. Luckily, the baby's about the size of a dollar. So it's not that hard to get baby out. Me and mom coordinate with each other. We're going to push. I'm going to pull. You're going to do this. I'm going to tug, whatever. We're going to get baby out. We get baby out. And there's a nuchal cord times two. Okay, so this baby's got a lot going against it. Number one, it's cold April morning. We're outside in the driveabout. Number two, baby's 27 weeks. Three, nuchal cord times two. Did I already say breech? I'm going to say it again. And number four is that I'm her doctor. Like, things can't get any worse. We get baby out, reduce the cord, clamp the cord. Baby's pulseless, lifeless, and as blue as the backpack you got for the conference. I deliver one breath. This baby literally fits in my hand like this. Literally, no joke about the size of a dollar bill, 2.8 kilograms. Deliver a breath, hold baby into my chest, and run like hell straight to the elevators where I hope and pray that I intubate the smallest airway I've ever seen. Heartbeat, spontaneous motion. She pinks right up. NICU team takes over. Baby's off and flying. No bloody way. I thought it was a little strange when they named her Jeff. So I asked him to soften it up a little bit and do Jeffrey Ann. And that seems to have worked. This is Lily, you guys. Okay. And Lily's already 3 years old. She's doing geometry. It turns out that first breath that the kid gets is really important. I was really, you know, factors into their overall intelligence. Lily and I are great friends. And so this kind of illustrates my point is that, you know, like, I really need to be there for you when you need me. Like, that's, If I went to medical school and residency and everything, and this was the only case that I was ever a part of, then it's worth it. Because Lily's going to grow up, and she's going to fall in love. She's going to have her heart broken. She's going to play in a stream. She's going to go camping. She's going to hate geometry, just like I did. But isn't that why we do this? The ripple effect of Lily's life is ongoing and will continue to ripple forever. She's going to influence this world somehow because she's here. She's alive because our teams were ready at a moment's notice. Hell, 5 minutes ago, I bet Rob and I, Dr. Ali and I, were probably shooting spit wads at each other, and then we're able to spring into action and do this because we were ready. And I love it. I mean, this is honestly, like, I just can't do this, right? Who has seen this guy in medicine? Right? Come on, go ahead, admit it. We've all seen this person in medicine. In the fourth year of our medical school, we were in Las Vegas. My wife and I had already had a successful pregnancy. We had a 2-year-old baby boy. And so we thought, that was cool, let's try that again. And so we did, we had a normal pregnancy, everything was great. And I was in a pathology test midway through when I got a call and a text from my wife that says, my water broke, I'm running to the hospital. So during the pathology test, I went C, 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 all the way down. I got like a 97 on that thing. It was awesome. Ran to the hospital as soon as my test was done, super excited, ran into the room, and immediately knew that this was not going to be a happy day. No heartbeat on the monitor. My wife is in tears, and we've lost this pregnancy. It was our due date. A lot of people have been through that, and it's horrifying. It is really, really terrible. Because you know in the back of your head, you've still got to deliver this baby. And there's no crying afterwards. I tried and tried and tried to be strong for my wife. But I ultimately had to go outside, and I sat against the wall and just lost it. And I crumpled in a heap of tears and sobbing over the loss of potential and what we still have to go through and so what we have to still go through and deliver. It was so overwhelming, I could not believe it. And in between a sob and a heave, I recognized that one of our nurses was knocking on a door down the hall to the anesthesiologist, as my wife still needed an epidural in order to be able to deliver. She knocked 2 or 3 times, and finally the door flew open, and out came the Hulk. As he flew into a fit of rage, cursing and yelling, screaming, that how dare she wake him up for something that was non-emergent. And he slammed the door and went straight back inside. The nurse left with clenched fists and tears in her eyes. And about an hour and a half later, Bruce Banner came into the room. It was the same guy, same anesthesiologist. He was so nice. He was so great. He came in and did an excellent epidural, no complications, excellent analgesia, not a problem. It was great. And then he left, and we go through the process of induction and delivery, which is its own story. But as soon as we deliver, the room is silent, somber, quiet, and the OB is down sewing because she had some tears. And me as a fourth-year medical student, I'd never really had any experience with it yet, but I'd read about it. I look down and my wife's heartbeat is like 210. Her blood pressure is 64. She's passing out. And I don't know what cued it into my mind because I'd never seen the process before, but I look down and all the blood, there were just no clots in it. So I don't really know how it ever entered my mind, but I just looked up and I looked at the doctor, I said, DIC. He goes, what? I said, she's in DIC. Look, she's in DIC, she's dying, go. Now we all know what DIC is here. It's this consumptive coagulopathy that usurps all of your coagulation cascade. And then because you have consumed everything, you have nothing left, and you hemorrhage out, and you bleed to death. So during the course of resuscitation, the OB calls in the anesthesiologist. Guess who comes in? Yeah, A-hole. A-hole comes in. And guess what? He's amazing. He's awesome. Methergan, Cytotec, FFP, give me 4 units of blood, give me this, go, go, go. And what I start noticing is why I'm telling you this story. Because as soon as he would ask for something, the nursing staff would say, you bet, doctor. He'd ask for something and hand it to him just out of reach. Over there. Never in his hand. They hate him. I realize that they, as a crew, have to live with this monster every day. And they hate him. And they're going to do everything they can to exact a price. If they want something, it's just out of reach for him. Now the whole team's at fault. I realize that this is my someone that they're treating. Every second is counting. Every moment matters. Every medication is crucial. DIC is one of the most amazing resuscitations you and I can exercise our brains on. And yet here they're dealing with this communication cascade to where somebody's a monster and then the crew becomes a monster taking it out on each other, which affects a patient, somebody's someone. Now it just happens to be mine. Give me one of these. You bet, sure. You and I operate in clinics, in operating rooms, in ERs, all across this state, all across the nation. It's vitally important that you and I recognize our own character flaws, our own personality flaws, and never let this happen to us or our team. Because you're going to work on somebody, someone, and it matters. You can't have these types of things interplaying. Why do you do this? How do you do this? What do you do? There's a case I'll never, ever, ever, ever forget in my entire life. It was the day after I took my MCAT, because I had already previously determined I wasn't going to be a dentist. And I was a tech here at McKady Hospital before I left for medical school and worked with some heroes like Rob Alley, Brian Smith, Neil Stagg, Paul Lane, Mike Halliday. And I remember there was a kid, his name's Eisen, he still works there. He called me just as, like, I swear I just circled the last C on my MCAT. And I got a call, say, hey, Jeff, I know you're done with your test, can you come in and just do 3 hours in the ER for me tonight? I'm like, yeah, you bet, like, I'll take more if you want, I'll take your whole shift. He's like, oh, I've just got a baptism to go to, could you just take 3 hours? Sure, I'll take more if you want, that's not a problem. He says, no, just 3 hours, that'll be good. So I came in for 3 hours. And the ER is kind of a fun place, right? I mean, you step into this storm. and you just get on a treadmill and you start running. You pick up where the last person left off and you just run until somebody taps you on the shoulder and say, hey, it's time for you to go. And you get off the treadmill and go home and rest and come back. Well, I stepped into the storm and started doing my duties as a tech, and I was the trauma tech that night when a level one trauma was called overhead. Who's been in a level one trauma here? Okay, most of us have in some way, shape, or form during our training, or whether that's part of your job now. Most of us have been in a level one trauma. It's really amazing to me. One of my favorite moments in medicine is to stand there. I'm an ER doc now, but to stand there in that room at the head of the bed and look around the room, like I'm looking around this room, and try to really conceptualize, how do you amass in your head how much experience is here in this room? How many tests? How many board exams? How many Christmas mornings? How many Saturday nights? How much goes in? You can just summarize it in your own life and then multiply it by this room, and you just, it's impossible. But to stand there in that room, to recognize that some person has just had something terribly misfortunate happen to them, and it's going to define the rest of their lives, and yet here we are in this room ready to rock. I've got anesthesia, I've got surgeons, I've got ICU, I've got ER, I've got phlebotomists, I've got nurses that are ready to find a vein no matter where. It's amazing. And there we were standing in this room waiting for this person to come in. We didn't know much. It's a 56-year-old, auto ped, auto bike, that's all we know. In the field, we know that they have done an ET tube. You've got pulses, large bore peripheral IVs, fluids open, it's a lights and sirens response, rapid transport to the emergency department. As this patient came in, I will never forget feeling like something, like I had stood up too quick. I've run so many traumas, and I've pulled bodies out of every canyon. As you step out here and look at these mountains, I've pulled bodies out of crevasses, I've rescued people out of avalanches, caves, rivers, mountaintops, mountain bottoms, you name it, and I've never felt this before or since, but I feel like something is wrong. I feel like I've stood up too quick when this person comes in to this ER. And our teams jump into action. IVs, medications, checking the airway. I do a 12-lead EKG. Then I put a Foley catheter in. And then this patient goes into PEA. And Dr. Brian Smith, who's been my mentor for so many years, is running this code, says, Hershey, start doing CPR. Now, who's done CPR here? I want you to stop and think about CPR. It's really hard to think about this in a BLS class. But CPR is one of those, there's a lot of intimate moments in life, right? Intimacy can be defined in lots of different ways, but think of CPR. Is there really, honestly, anything more intimate than CPR? As you and I are literally somebody's heartbeat, somebody's blood flow to their heart, lungs, kidneys, and brain, and you are that mechanism. You are in their space. You're in their chest. You're in their anatomy. You're in their face and their air. You're in their smells. You're in everything. You're in the blood, the urine. You're in everything. That's you. And you are that mechanism to hold that person onto whatever, like this side of whatever the opposite we are on. And that's your job, CPR. Wow, CPR. I'll never forget this, being involved in this patient's CPR as his head was caved in on one side, severe trauma, both eyes enucleated. I remember his right arm was completely degloved, like an anatomy lesson. And I remember even some of the nurses asking, like, well, we can't get a vein, we can't get a vein. And I remember, like, doing CPR, I'm like, you want veins, they're right there. Look at his right arm. And they did. They went over and cannulated the right arm's vasculature, right? Just because it was just right there. It was like bodies in Las Vegas. We do a couple of rounds of CPR. Things are not going well. And Dr. Smith says, Hershey, stop CPR, check pulses. And as I went down to left femoral to check for femoral pulse, I see something that I recognize as maybe one of the first things I ever saw in my entire life. And I look over this body, and I immediately know why I feel the way I do. The room stops as I begin sobbing and cry out, "Oh, Dad." And this is my dad. And that ring's the only thing that I can recognize as him. And I stop and I sob and I sob, and Dr. Smith puts me on his shoulder and hauls me out of the room and says, "Hershey, what's wrong with you? I've never seen you act this way. What's wrong with you? I mean, Brian, that's my dad." He goes, "No, it's not. It's not your dad. Just collect yourself and get back in here when you can." I said, "No, Brian, that's my dad." I pointed out the shoes that were in the corner on the linen in room 3 at McKady ER, Sawtooth Ridge, North Face shoes, size 9, too big for me. I gave them to my dad. There was a scar underneath this guy's chin that he got when he was 16 years old on his first bicycle and fell into the curb at Brigham City just outside of Safeway. I ran back in to tell him to stop. My dad was never going to be my dad again. This was devastating trauma, and we need to let him go. The room has, of course, erupted into trying to save who's now Jeff's dad. And so stopping that was huge. It was a big decision. I didn't have family there, I didn't have my mom there, I didn't have anybody there, but I just knew that my dad was gone. What's genius about it is that I went 17 minutes, I've got the trauma charts, I went 17 minutes before I recognized that it was him. And the miracle of that is that I know in my heart that I had done everything that I could possibly do to help this person. All of my training, all those lonely nights studying, all the techniques that I'd practiced over and over went in with full hope, with full faith, that I was doing everything I could for him. And I knew that my team was doing the same. If I saw my dad tomorrow, which I don't want to right now, that means something bad for me, I'd be able to look at my dad and say, "Dad, look, Dad, we did," he'd just say, "Yeah, I know, let's go backpacking." I think it's really important as we progress and go through our days that we really put that kind of effort into people. If I had been thinking about my cold sandwich or the oxygen bottles that I needed to to stuff up or put the bandages away or worry about what the Jazz were doing during that, and 2 hours later somebody comes and taps me on the shoulder and says, "Hey, Hershey, that guy in room 3, that was your dad." I mean, he was a genius dad. He was a businessman here. Got his honorary doctorate from Weber State from the business department. He ran a greeting card company that went all over the world on him and made people laugh. He was a wonderful father. In my 28 years with him, I have more memories than you can possibly imagine. I don't know why father and son had to go through this in the ER, other than I was given an option to have this be a blessing in my life or a curse in my life. And I remember choosing that this was going to benefit me somehow. It's the day after I took my MCAT. It was a real big choice as to whether to proceed into medicine or not. I can promise you that I would not be here as a physician. I would certainly not be at McCady Hospital, and I would certainly not be in the emergency department where this happened if I had not given everything I knew to my dad that night. And so when I walk into room 7 or room 2 or room 3 for somebody, someone, I can promise you that I will give them everything that I have. Your next patient will be somebody, someone, somebody's lover, somebody's granddaughter, somebody's mommy, somebody's brother. Why do you do this? Not what, not even how. Nobody cares. Why do you and I do this? We invite so many things into our lives that we can't unsee, can't unsmell, can't unlive. I can't tell you how many nights in the dark I spend with so many people's lives in my head and in my heart, wondering if they're okay. Wonder if they made it. Did I do the right thing? I tried. It didn't work. But again, I'm compelled. I have to be there for you when you need me. That's what I need. We do this. We save this one save at a time. There's a dark prophecy, and you guys have gathered what prophecy you prefer to fight, because you're special and you're warriors, and we fight along the front lines of humanity. But matriarchs and patriarchs of multiple generations will come back home because of you. Grandma's going to make her world-famous lasagna one more time because of you. And kids are going to grow up and love popcorn at the movie theater because of you. The lonely and the afraid and the people that have no one might have me, they might have you, for 2 or 3 hours, for a cold sandwich and a brand new pair of socks. And that's us. I hope as you review WIT, and I hope as you review Simon Sinek, that you reflect on what we've talked about here. The joys of medicine are absolutely real and powerful. Seeing pictures of Lily every year on her birthday is immeasurable to me. There's nothing that gets in the way of that. What we have the opportunity to do through our training, testing, and our dedication to our fellow man brings us immeasurable joy. That's the heart and soul of what this conference is really and truly about, is the joy of medicine. Meeting an 85-year-old female with abdominal pain, she's so cute, she's so fun, she's got so much experience, is thrilling. To hear her story, what does she love? Her grandkids. Just in room 27 on a normal day. It's beautiful. Thank you for your time. Thank you for what you do. Thank you for allowing me to be one of your colleagues. I appreciate you so much.
think we'll adjourn until 2 o'clock. Thank you, Jeff.